Yeah, well, I think what you're describing is an appropriate use of artificial intelligence, which is as a tool to assist, you know, litigators and decision makers in doing their job. I don't think we're heading towards a world where the judges are replaced by AI, and I don't think we're moving towards a world where the lawyers are replaced by AI.
Welcome to Crime Scene Gold Coast with Guardian Criminal Law. My name's Mark Savick, I'm the Principal of Guardian Criminal Law, and we'll be bringing you podcasts weekly. Variety of topics that can be very sensitive, so please be careful when you're listening, and if you need any assistance at all, we'll include a lifeline number at the bottom of the page. Really appreciate you subscribing and liking our podcast channel. You can listen to us across most social media platforms, Spotify, YouTube, TikTok, and you'll find us there. We look forward to bringing you many episodes in the future. Welcome to Crime Scene Gold Coast. We're really privileged to have Mr. Nick James as our guest today. Nick's the Dean of the Law School at Bond University here on the Gold Coast. Bond University is where I graduated from, and some of the other solicitors here. Very pleased to have Nick with us. Welcome, Nick. Welcome to Crime Scene Gold Coast.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I'm happy for Bond University to take credit for all of your success.
Thank you. And it can take a lot of credit for our success. It was a wonderful educational experience. We were talking earlier, and I was explaining that I'd been to the Australian National University straight after I came out of high school, and then a couple of years later I went to Sydney University for a period of time. Both excellent institutions.
Excellent,
and,
yeah.
And I had a lovely experience at both of them. But when I came to Bond and started to study at Bond, it was a totally different platform. It was so closely connected with the students. You knew your lecturers. You knew your tutors. It was like family, and you were really guided very closely through the law degree. Still the same?
Still the same. Look, Australia's blessed with some excellent universities, but there's certainly something different about Bond. Without this turning into too much of a marketing pitch for Bond University, but look, it's a private university while all the other ones are public universities, and we charge a bit more for what we provide, which means that we have to do it better than anyone else. And I like to think we're able to do that. We were talking earlier about the metaphor of flying economy class versus flying business class, and there's certain people who are happy to pay a bit extra in order to have a better experience, and that's how Bond fits in.
Do you ever remember, or did you know of, a lecturer who attended Bond? He came, I think, 2 or 3 years in a row, and his name was John Vargo from the United States.
I think it was before my time.
A bit before your time.
Yeah.
He was the most dynamic lecturer. He was amazing. And at his lectures, you'd go to his lectures and it'd be standing room only, and half of the lecture theatre weren't even studying law. They were just coming for the sheer entertainment of it. And he was reflective of a lot of the lecturers that had deep professional experience in the law. He was representing, I think, Chrysler Motor Company was a client. He ran a famous case involving the old band Lynyrd Skynyrd and something with pyrotechnics on the stage, and he was there. I think Harley Davidson Motorcycles was a client of his, so it was really top end. So having that sort of experience to learn from, sensational.
You know, it makes an enormous difference. I mean, that's a shift that we've seen in law schools right across the country over the last few decades. So when I went to law school in the 1980s, it was doctrinal. So it was very much professors in the classroom telling you about the legislation, telling you about the cases. You took your notes, you went to your tutorials, you did your exams, and that was the study of law, highly theoretical. Whereas there was a real shift, and I'd like to think that Bond sort of led the way in that it said, look, the study of law is more than just the study of legal texts. You need to learn about the actual life of the law and the practice of law. And so we leaned into that. And I think, pretty much every law school around Australia now recognises that you've got to expose law students to the realities of legal practice, as well as continue to teach them about legal principles and legal theories and legal doctrines. But they also need to develop legal skills. They need to have the opportunity to engage with legal practitioners. They need to be inspired to be legal professionals. I think we've gotten really good at that.
Yeah, and I remember very fondly the moot court program, so that you're actually doing practice in a simulated environment. It was incredible. And now that I'm practicing law, and from my early days of practicing law, that made a big difference. And I do recall going to complete my diploma in legal practice at the College of Law in St. Leonard's in Sydney. And part of that process was to conduct a moot court, and there were some exercises that you had to do. And everybody that went to bond that was there received very similar compliments or observations from the teachers, and that was, you've obviously done this before.
That's it.
And so it really did empower us to go through that course very well.
Yeah. So if any of your listeners don't know, mooting is a simulated courtroom experience. So it's where you put law students in the role of lawyers in a court, you know, in a simulated courtroom environment in front of a bench, and you get them to actually do what they would be doing if they were appearing in court. And it's an extraordinary experience. Even if the student isn't planning on becoming a litigator, just the they have to do the legal research, they have to prepare their case, they then have to often suit up, they have to be prepared to actually stand up, present their argument with interventions from the bench. It's like, as I explain it to high school kids about to come to law school, it's like debating on steroids. It makes debating look easy because you're constantly interrupted with really tough questions. And, and you're not allowed to say, oh, no, I'll get to that point later. You've got to stop what you're talking about, shift tact, answer the judge's question, and then reorganize your presentation on the fly. So you have to learn to think on your feet. It's so challenging and so rewarding when you do it right, that you know, there's a healthy, thriving moot court competition world where law students from law schools not only compete with each other within the law school to win moots, but you know, law schools put teams up against teams from other law schools. So we have
international
mooting competitions, and the fact that because bond's smaller, we're actually able to use mooting in our subjects. So every single law student gets exposed to mooting during their degree, which isn't the case in, you know, in larger law schools where it's just too resource intensive. But that does mean that our students get really, really good at mooting.
Some of the business students get exposed to it as well.
Well, we run a national high school mooting competition. So we're in the middle of running that at the moment, where we give high school students right across the country the opportunity. Not all of them become law students, but the schools and the teachers recognize that it's such an amazing learning experience that it's worth anybody having a go at it.
I've been involved with it. I was involved with it when I was practicing out of Tamworth in New South Wales. And I was, may have come across through an email, but it was an offer to volunteer as either a tutor or as a magistrate.
Yep.
And I did both of those. 1 year I did the magistrate's role, and 1 year I did the tutoring role. It was fantastic. I think it was year 11 students for some reason come to mind. It wasn't year 12.
It's year 11s and 12s that actually participate in these competitions.
Yeah. So I was associated with some year 11 students. It was a great experience.
Yeah, they love it.
I have a good friend who we hadn't seen each other for a long time, and we've reconnected over recent months. He went to Bond University. Larger than life character, Randall Rankin. Mm-hmm. He was one of the grinders on Australia Too, so operating the lifting and lowering of the sails. Very, very physical, you know, role to play on a professional sailing boat. And that was must have been an incredible experience to be on Australia Too defending the America's Cup.
Yeah.
And he went to uni with us, and he graduated with a business degree. And we've reconnected now and see each other on a regular basis. And there wouldn't be one time that we get together where he doesn't say, wow, we got an incredible education at Bond, didn't we? It was just the best, wasn't it? You know. And Sam, we've been out in the workplace for a long time now. So it really is testament to the institution that it is. With the law school, when I was there, there wasn't a criminology department. Can you tell us a little bit about criminology as opposed to the study of law as I completed my law degree? Mm. What criminology is focused on?
We do now have a criminology degree, but it's over in the Faculty of Society and Design because it's seen as quite a separate discipline from the practice of law.
So it's more like a social science discipline looking
Precisely.
At the psychology
That's
of
it.
Criminals.
And not- criminal behaviour, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. I'm with that. So we keep
the criminologists separate from the lawyers and the criminal lawyers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nick, we just mentioned something a little earlier that I think is really relevant now with regard to education and professional life, and that's the advent of artificial intelligence.
Yep.
And it's how long has ChatGPT been out?
I think late last year it became publicly available. So some of us started dabbling with OpenAI.
So it's only months.
Yeah, it's only months. And then ChatGPT became available. And, you know, I heard somebody recently explaining that the sort of the sign-up rate for ChatGPT compared to, you know, Facebook and Twitter, where it just blew them out of the water in terms of the number of users within a month of ChatGPT far exceeded any other platform that had ever been released.
We use it on a daily basis here in our office.
But the sort of the public awareness of it spread like wildfire.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody heard about it, and because it was free, people started jumping in and playing with it. So we'd never seen anything like it before. And of course now it feels like there isn't a day that goes past without some news story about either ChatGPT's new abilities or some critique of AI and how it's nowhere near as good as people think it is, or, you know, the negative or the positive repercussions of AI. So for anybody that's trying to follow the conversation at the moment, it's a bewildering range of perspectives and views on what is probably going to turn out to be a major social transformation. So in the academy, of course, we're wrestling with the implications of AI for assessments.
Yes, yes.
And as always, there's positive and negative implications for higher education generally and legal education in particular. So every day I'm talking to people over in the law school about what are we going to do about this? How are we going to manage that? How do we stop students from misusing AI in their assessments? How do we encourage students to use AI in a productive way?
So it's going to be important to incorporate AI as part of the educational process, and we're seeing it now as part of the professional process. So do you see that there will be an introduction of a specific AI subject and perhaps even it becoming a core subject across all degrees?
No. So I think... So initially the reaction for many educators and many institutions was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. They saw AI, generative AI, as a way for students to cheat, all right? Because it it can write essays very, very quickly and easily. And at the time, we were still, because of the pandemic, using a lot of online assessments. So a lot of students in universities right around the world, instead of the old-fashioned go to an exam hall, sit down for 2 hours and write a paper, they were doing their assessments online, essentially take-home exams. Now ChatGPT comes along and suddenly you have to ask, did the student write this or did an AI write this? So a lot of institutions, the reaction was, we need to ban the use of AI because otherwise we can't regulate it. Since then, the conversation's become a lot more nuanced. One, you can't ban AI. It's everywhere.
That's right.
And in
That's
fact,
right.
it's going to be even more pervasive than it is already very, very quickly. You know, Microsoft's talking about embedding it in Word. Before you know it, Siri will be AI based. So it'll be everywhere. You can't escape it. So there's no point banning it. And the point that you were making, that practitioners are going to be using AI. So really, rather than trying to stop students using it, we need to teach them how to use it appropriately. We need to put in place precautions to ensure that it can't be misused in assessments, which is why you're seeing unexpectedly a swing right across the sector back to good old-fashioned invigilated in-person exams. So at Bond, next semester in law, after a few years of pandemic-driven online assessments, we're all going back to the exam halls. It won't be pen and paper like the old days.
That was my experience. Yeah. It was good old pen and paper.
We're at a point now where the only time a student picks up a pen is to write an exam. the handwriting's terrible. I don't want to mark that. So it'll be, you know, going forward, it'll be bring your own laptop to do the exam. And we can lock down laptops now so they can't access things without approval. Right. But
Nick, in our time, we've seen it move from handwritten to digital format.
Yep.
I've got I know young professionals that are graduated. They've graduated with a degree. They're practicing in their profession, and they don't know how to hold a pen properly.
That's it.
It's the writing looks like you've tied the pen onto a chicken's leg and just let them go. There's a doctor's handwriting is far better than some of these.
I've noticed it with my handwriting as well. It's just we're simply not writing as much as we used to.
And I've asked them. I've asked a question. So you don't use cursive writing anymore? And they look at me stunned because they don't understand what cursive writing is.
Yeah.
How do you explain that for all the younger viewers? Cursive writing is where all the letters are joined together and your writing flows. So each word is like one stroke of the pen.
Still legible.
And beautifully legible. Yeah. My father had the most gorgeous handwriting. His invoices that he used to send to the council, I reckon you could frame one. It was like calligraphy, but it comes from a different time.
That's
a different sort of education, a different training.
So we have no intention of teaching law students handwriting.
We've given up on that.
All right, we're just going to go to, you know, using devices on assessments.
So. Absolutely, that's where we're going, and it's just moved so fast.
Oh, and it's during the pandemic when, you know, pretty much everybody had to move online assessments, we thought, well, this is the future. This is the way to go. So when AI came along this year and we've all gone, well, maybe not. Maybe we will go back to in-person exam hall style assessments. But no, we're not going all the way back to pen and paper.
You mentioned previously, and I think that I may have planted the seed, and I was saying that we have been looking at AI here in our office. The main thing that we've used it for is for the writing of blogs to put onto our website, and that assists with our organic growth in the search engine optimization world so that our rankings rise. We haven't found it necessarily faster than what we were doing previously, because previously we were taking information from government sites, acknowledging where that came from, and then it's sort of like just republishing something that had already been drafted. So it might be an article on drink driving in southeast Queensland or domestic violence in Queensland. But we've found that with the ChatGPT, we can type in a question, say, can you please formulate a 600-word article on low-range drink driving in southeast Queensland? And it provides a really nice, succinct, you know, is it the best, academically, the best document that you've ever read? Answers to that is no. But is it acceptable? Absolutely. So it'll only get better and better. And I could see that at some stage it might get used for summary offences, so summary criminal offences in the local court. So if you did have a low-range drink driving offence and you can see that it's not going to carry a custodial sentence, so the outcome's going to be a fine and a disqualification of the licence for a short time or some other sort of blend of sentencing, that there may come a time where the police will send the details of the offence to you. You punch in a number into the computer. The AI then researches the sentencing and would probably give a far more consistent outcome. Not that our magistrates aren't quite incredible in the job that they do, but could give us a far more consistent outcome, because magistrates themselves are usually quite consistent. And then across the board of magistrates, there's a variance. There's a variance. And I know in law school we study a whole range of reasons why that variance might occur. You know, things like life experience, for example, could sway one magistrate to impose a slightly harsher penalty for an offence, but not outside the range of penalties, well within the range, and nothing that one would appeal. But still there can be an inconsistency, and we as lawyers understand that. And once we get to know our local magistrates, we sort of understand where they're going with it as well. And when we work closely with them, we're generally on the money together. The magistrate and yourself are going in the direction together, often ask questions on that journey. And once you become an experienced practitioner, to ask a magistrate, where are you at the moment? Like, where's your mind at the moment? And a lot of magistrates will say, well, look, this is what I'm thinking of doing at the moment. Can you convince me to do something other than that?
Yeah.
And so you'll engage in a process so that you get it right. So your job as a criminal lawyer, criminal defense lawyer, is to represent people through their journey in the criminal law. And there's also this duty to assist the court to get it right. Whether your duty to the court is higher than the duty to the client, that's a matter for debate. There's a lot of articles out there that you can read that sway one way or the other, some of them saying it's equal. But there is a duty to the court to get it right. So you go through this process to ensure that you put the evidence before the court in an honest and transparent manner so that the magistrate or the judge can perform their job and hopefully we get the right outcome. And this AI seems to me could provide an extremely consistent platform for sentencing and summary offences. Then, much to my surprise, you said, already being done, son. So tell us a little bit about your knowledge of where this is being used for exactly that purpose.
Yeah, well, I think what you're describing is an appropriate use of artificial intelligence, which is as a tool to assist, you know, litigators and decision makers in doing their job. I don't think we're heading towards a world where the judges are replaced by AI, and I don't think we're moving towards a world where the lawyers are replaced by AI, for a whole range of reasons. I mean, the AI is good at looking at historical data, identifying trends, and providing recommendations about what, you know, the next decision should be in order to be consistent with past trends. But there's always other complications, other human factors that need to be taken into account by the human judge in making the final decision. So it's, you know, AI will become a useful, if not essential, tool for certainly for practitioners. And I suspect in Australia, members of the judiciary are already thinking very carefully about, you know, how can I use an AI to help me do my job without necessarily taking away my responsibility to do what I'm supposed to do. As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, when you're talking about the duty to the court and duty to the client, AI doesn't and can't hold those duties.
That's right.
So it's entirely inappropriate to replace the human actors with artificial intelligence. I think China for quite a few years now has been experimenting with using AI in decision-making processes, certainly in lower levels in the court system there. A lot of the day-to-day administrative decisions are being, if not supplemented by AI, actually made by AI entirely. But even here in the West, eBay has been resolving disputes about online purchases using algorithms and generative AI for quite a long time. I was told a story a couple of years ago by a German practitioner, which made me realize of the capacity for this sort of thing to revolutionize the system. He was working in an area of employment law, and the laws there, like here, entitled somebody who was dismissed unfairly to compensation. So they had set up an online interface on their website where they asked a potential client a series of questions. And then the algorithm that they developed was able to predict the percentage likelihood that they would be able to recover compensation. And their arrangement was that if it was greater than 80%, that the client would take on the matter on spec. But they were so confident that the algorithm was getting it right that they started saying to the client, look, if you enter all your details and it spits out a chance of success of greater than 80%, we'll pay you your claim. And then we'll go off and take care of it. So you could actually get your unfair dismissal claim paid out instantly, straight into your bank account. And then they would go off and approach the insurance company and say, all right, and then try and recover the actual money. But the insurance company was so impressed by the capacity of this algorithm that it said, well, if your algorithm says it's 80% or more, we'll just pay it.
Okay.
So suddenly you're taking all this work completely out of the court system because the algorithm was able to competently predict what the likely outcome would be. That's transformative. It also is incredibly problematic because now all these matters that, as we know, within our common law legal system actually contribute to the development of the law, if you take all that work out of the court system and actually have it being resolved automatically by technology, those matters are no longer contributing to the life of the law anymore. And the law, in a worst case scenario, where everything gets pulled out of the courts and starts getting resolved by AI, the law stops developing. It's frozen at the point where that took place.
That's right. I see. That's really clear.
Yeah.
Because it's relying upon pre-existing information.
Up to the point of that of where that process started.
So you still need that development, and the development, will the AI become such that it can develop?
Well, it won't, because the court system is the one that's responsible for developing, you know, for modifying existing rules to according to new circumstances. That stops happening once you automate the process.
That's
so
right.
I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's one of the risks associated with shifting too many disputes into sort of technology-enabled resolution.
So it might be the case that there's a whole lot of technology-enabled resolution, and then there's an appeals process to deal with it. Maybe that's going to be part of the developmental side.
Well, I think that would be a positive outcome. So at the moment, we know there's an access to justice issue and that the vast majority of members of the community can't actually access legal dispute resolution processes, either because they can't afford it or they don't even realize that they've got a legal action that they could take. If we could address that unmet need with automated processes, you're not replacing lawyers with artificial intelligence. You're just adding a new lower level of dispute resolution, which is automated. And then if at any point people are unhappy with that result, you appeal, and that's where the human factor comes in. So it's the existing hierarchy is in place, but now you've got a much larger lower band where more people can actually access legal services.
Yeah.
That would be a wonderful outcome.
Well, so I had this picture in my mind. It may be being fed from science fiction movies and books, that people that are charged with summary offences would get some sort of document, punch a number into a machine, and the machine would spit out their sentence. You know, here's your fine and here's your disqualification and a note about what they're doing. And that might be like almost like an ATM type of situation, or it could be just an online situation at home where you just punch a number in and away it goes. Maybe that's a little bit too far-fetched.
It's probably not that far-fetched at all. I mean, I can see that those sorts of decisions, you'd have to make it clear to the parties, whoever they are, whether it's the state and a citizen or two citizens, that this is a non-binding prediction of what would happen if you actually went to court. Now, if they both accept that, great, the matter's sorted, move on. But if one of them or both of them don't accept it, then they have a right to then appeal that and start to activate the formal legal dispute resolution process.
Yeah.
So that first stage can be instant, can be automatic.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. There's I think the point where there's a bit of controversy at the moment is the extent to which AI can make its way into the formal judicial process. So, you know, we were talking about whether judges can and should use it, but I don't know if you've been following the news about the do not pay. Well, not really a firm. It was actually set up quite a few years ago where an early adopter of this sort of technology made that algorithm, that chat algorithm, freely available. It's super simplistic. It was nothing like generative AI, but it did make it possible for people in the UK at the time, if they had, say, a claim against an airline for lost luggage, to go into this chat interface, provide some details, and it would spit out a letter of demand to the airline instantly for free. And they could then use that to try and get compensation. Do not pay over the last few years has kind of expanded operations considerably and is embracing generative AI to the point where, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, they wanted to send somebody into the courtroom with an earbud in place, self-represented litigant, but it was going to be fed their lines by the AI in order to respond to what the judge was asking. And when the judge realized what was going on, forbade that sort
so
of,
that happened here in Australia?
No, this was in the UK, I think. Where
in the UK?
They tried to give it a go and it was... And since then, there's been commentary by various judges and senior practitioners saying we would never, never allow that sort of corruption of the judicial process by letting an AI actually appear in court through a human interface
in order
to argue a case. So I think, you know, you can have your pre-litigation dispute resolution non-binding done by tech, but once it gets to the courtroom, it's humans only, I'm afraid.
I didn't even think of that. But what I was thinking about was somebody gets charged with a fairly minor offence. Say it's a common assault and they've never been charged with anything before. And they go on to an AI that's similar to GPT chat, but it's designed specifically for legal matters. And they can just hit, like pre-fill some criteria, name, address, date of birth, the facts associated with the particular matter, and then hit a button that is submissions. And then the AI produces written submissions for the court. And so you go in and you provide those written submissions for the court for your sentence. That's very similar to what we're talking about, except it's in paper form rather than in spoken form.
Yeah. I think it's going to be up to the registrar whether or not they accept or whether they would even know.
Yeah. Because I tried it. I asked for submissions on sentence and gave some parameters. And it didn't give me sentencing submissions, but it gave me a really good, about 800 to 1,000 word article on the law of drink driving in southeast Queensland and what sort of sentences can be expected for a first-time offender. And it was quite well written. So it wasn't submissions as we would prepare them, but is it going to get better and better? I mean, this has access to everything, doesn't it? All of the information on the planet, like that's on the internet.
Well, it's as up to a certain date. So it's historical data. So first of all, there's a new version of ChatGPT that came out yesterday, ChatGPT-4,
okay,
which is meant to be exponentially more capable than the ones we were using 2 days ago.
Okay.
But there's limited access to that one at the moment. But the ChatGPT that we've all been playing with for the last few months is programmed on historical data. So it's not scouring the internet for answers. It has analyzed a massive set of data from the internet as at, I think it was 2021. So it is a couple of years out of date. But the data that was programmed with, a massive database of real human conversation and interaction, it's Reddit, it's Wikipedia, it's those huge troves of data that it's analyzed, worked out how it all fits together, and now uses that to predict the most likely response to the question. So, I mean, I'm not an IT expert, but you know, we often think if you ask ChatGPT a question, it's going onto the internet and searching for the answer. That's not what's happening. It's worked out what words and concepts are most likely to be associated with that kind of question, and it constructs its response. And it's very, very good at it because it looks like an actual coherent response, but it's actually written that response. It hasn't found it somewhere.
Yes, yeah. That's right. So it's taken the information and fashioned a response from that information.
That's it. And it's able to do that.
It's thinking about it.
At the moment, it's 2 years out of date. So it's only used that historical data. But I'm not sure where ChatGPT-4, but future versions, it's going to be live. It will be scouring the entire internet to look for current information. Well, so, yeah, I think it is going to be capable of doing those sorts of things. I've spoken to a few people who point out that the ones we're playing with at the moment are general generative AI and that they're looking at all the information. But when we're able to take that tool and apply it to very specific troves of information, like all the precedents from Australian case law or the sorts of private databases that publishers like LexisNexis have, if it had access to that data and only that data, not Reddit conversations about murder, but just the hard law, and then use that to construct a response, now you're going to get some really high quality work coming out of it.
And it's happening so quickly.
It's happening so quickly.
Well, by the end of the year, it'll be amazing.
Yeah. So this is, we had a conference last year where the keynote speaker was somebody who was speaking about this just ahead of it taking off. So he was right on top of it. And his tagline was, it's bigger than fire.
Wow.
In terms of human development, this is bigger than fire.
Wow. That is amazing. I saw documentaries about the development of writing and how we'd be, if writing was developed 40,000 years before it was, like the future that we'd be in now would be so incredibly different.
Yeah.
So it was very powerful, yes. So this will be just as powerful as fire. Wow. Yeah, I was watching one of my staff yesterday, one of the solicitors here. We had a little project on yesterday, we were trying to brainstorm a name for a company. And we had certain parameters that we wanted to fulfill. Like it had to be a strong name. It had to show integrity. There was some sort of key ideas around that name. And so I was sitting there with pen and paper and mucking around. And then I saw one of our solicitors was on the computer onto ChatGPT and asking it to generate names for this particular style of company. And then what surprised her, I generated a list of names, but she then typed in, "That's not really good enough. I think you should have another try." And it did. And it came back with a whole lot more names and much better responses.
Yeah.
And said, "Is that okay now?" And she says, "No, not really. It's not what we're looking for." And it goes and it tries again. And I was watching this and I was watching her having a full-on interaction with the AI. And she'd gotten into a comfort zone and it was like she was talking to somebody. Perhaps I could use the example of, say, email.
Yep.
It was like there was somebody else on the other end.
That's it. You can tease out better and better responses. You know, there's a lot of critics who are explaining that the output of ChatGPT is rubbish, you know, that it's uncreative, it's inaccurate a lot of the time. It makes stuff up. Over in the academy, a lot of it was around referencing. You know, initially, if you asked ChatGPT to provide references for what it was saying, academic references, it literally made up articles and books and things like that. Because again, it's not looking for the answers. It would say, well, if I'm looking for a book that supports my point about, you know, how laptops work, the most likely name of the author would be this because this person's written a lot about that. And the most likely name of the book would be this because out of 100 books on laptops, these are the most common words. So it would construct the most likely title and the publisher would probably be this. So it's creating a source because that's how it creates all its information, the most likely correct answer. But the actual references never existed, right? Of course, you know, in the last few weeks, they've gotten on top of that. And now there's generative AI that's perfectly capable of providing academic references, academic sources.
Well, and so generating academic papers.
Potentially, yeah. I was at a conference last week where I was talking about ChatGPT because it's the hot topic at the moment. And I told them I put in an abstract for one of the speaker's papers and said, "Now write the paper." And it was able to extrapolate. It wasn't brilliant, but it wasn't bad. It was certainly on topic. And I had to say, well, I hope that's not what you did when you actually present your paper. You're just going to read out the ChatGPT generated version.
Yeah.
But it can do that. It can extrapolate from an academic description an academic paper. A not bad one.
I've been thinking about it in terms of work applications, academic applications. But now I'm starting to think about it in terms of people having a connection with the technology that's almost personal. Have you ever asked it to generate jokes?
Yes, poetry as well, short stories.
Oh, we did an experiment the other day. We asked it to write a haiku about the weather. It was great.
No, it can do that. There was an author of children's novels who had written the first two books in a series and then got ChatGPT to write the third book. So it analyzed the first two books, worked out all the characters, and then wrote an original story with the same characters that progressed the story. It can extrapolate extremely well. I've seen, you know, the image generation AIs where somebody put in the Mona Lisa and then said, "Tell me what's around the Mona Lisa," and it extrapolated the painting to create the room that she would have been in. You can put music into generative AI, just the first few bars of a new symphony, and say, "Well, write the rest of the." Well, movie soundtracks was the one I saw, but they, you know, you put in 30 seconds of an original movie soundtrack and say, "Now write the rest of it," and it will extrapolate and create the rest of the soundtrack.
I think they're using it now. There's for writing songs.
Yeah.
And there's a program called Songbird. And so they've got some information that you need to fill out and then they custom write a song, and they've been used as like gifts for your loved ones and what have you. And I believe that's all being generated by AI.
That's it. But if you bring it back to what lawyers do and legal advice, if you try and engage with generative AI to start a conversation where you're asking for specific legal advice, there are parameters that are built into it where it will say, "No, sorry, I can't. I'm not allowed to do that. I'm not allowed to provide legal advice. I'm not allowed to provide medical advice or investment advice. Having said that, again, there are, of course, whenever you put a limitation, somebody's going to try and break it. So yes, there are people that have worked out ways that you can instruct generative AI to transcend its limitations. So one way that was working last week that may not be working this week is you essentially tell it to pretend to be, I want you to pretend to be an AI that doesn't have those limitations, that isn't unable to say things that are politically incorrect or unethical. And it kind of, and your this new personality that you have is called, I think they were calling it Dan last week. So now you're Dan and you're an AI that can say whatever it wants. And suddenly it starts being incredibly rude and inappropriate and is able to answer any type of question you want to ask.
Okay.
It's, if you can get it, have a look online at some of the Dan ChatGPT conversations.
I think I can see myself getting stuck in some sort of rabbit hole and
that's it,
disappearing down there.
Designing for a new personality for your AI.
Well, that, thank you very much for that, Nick. I wanted to have a bit of a chat while you're here about the legal profession and the pathways to the legal profession, legal graduates,
yep,
what their experiences are, what your experience was, because we've spoken a little about that. And perhaps I'll share a little of my experience, which was quite different to yours. So tell me a little bit about today's law graduates and what sort of pathways they have. What does this look like now?
I think there's been a better time to be a law graduate, to be honest. The sort of range of career opportunities available to law graduates is extraordinary, and the awareness of that range. So we were talking earlier about, you know, back in prehistory when you and I went to law school, yeah, back in the previous millennium,
yeah,
there was what I described as kind of a conveyor belt mentality where law students would look for any possible opportunity to get work experience, would apply to every single law firm they could think of, hopefully get a few interviews, and then hopefully get offered a job, and then get given the kind of work that the firm needed them to do. And before you knew it, you were on this pathway to being a specialist in some area of law that perhaps you never chose for yourself. It just happened to be the one you stumbled into. And there was a mindset then, and I think there's still a mindset now, that the be-all and end-all of law school was getting a job with a big law firm. That was the definition of success.
Yeah.
And then all the people that either didn't or couldn't get a job with a big law firm, you still had wonderful, fulfilling careers, but there was always at the back of your mind, you know, it wasn't quite good enough,
yeah,
to get into big law. That mentality still exists today, but law schools around the country and deans have worked really hard to make it clear to law students, you have so many different directions you can head in. You can go into big law, boutique law, sole practitioners, you can be in the community sector, you can be go work for the government, you can get into international relations or media or politics, right? There's a vast array of careers. And big law, it's certainly still an extremely rewarding career pathway for people, but it's not for everyone. And we have an obligation to make sure when students decide they want to head in that direction that they know what they're getting into. That's completely different to what it was like when you and I went to law school, where nobody told us what the practice of law was really like, and we didn't discover
it
until
we
actually arrived at work on our first day. And we weren't prepared, we had no skills, and we just kind of learned on the job.
That now, is so true.
Yeah. Now we want students to know what they're getting into and make informed choices.
Yeah. What was your experience like? Where did you go and work once you finished law school?
I ended up working in commercial law. A few years down the track, I found myself becoming a commercial leasing expert, and for initially a medium-sized law firm that got swallowed up by a large law firm. And I just sort of woke up one day and said, I never chose this. I'm good at it. I could keep going. I could become quite a successful lawyer in this space, but this wasn't what I dreamed of doing as a child. What am I doing? How did I get here? And I took some time out and went backpacking and, you know, did some other types of work that was non-legal and thought about what I really wanted to do, and then came back and made an informed choice to actually explore becoming an academic. And then I discovered my passion. So one of the things I try and do as a dean is make sure my students don't have to discover a few years in that they need to change direction, that they actually make the choice while they're at law school as to where they want to go.
I'm lucky that I practicing in an area of law that I'm very passionate about too. It's makes it easy to get up in the morning and to apply yourself and to be focused. It's important that it was always been important to me that the work that I was doing held some importance other than a financial importance. There's something else that needs to be nourished in a human being. I know the financial component is a reality of life, but it needs to be something where I feel like I'm contributing, and the criminal law has provided me with that. I was listening to a very interesting article recently, and they were talking about where people get stuck in a profession or in a lifestyle. And as you were saying, you know, I can do this, I'm good at it, I can keep on doing this forever. And they were saying that often people get stuck, and a lot of it's to do with personality traits, because the situation that they're in is not bad enough, and they would actually be better off if their situation deteriorated.
Yeah.
So they're in a job, they're making enough money, they're getting enough free time, they're not ecstatic, you know, about going to work, but it's ticking all the boxes of survival. And before you know it, 40 years later, you're retiring and you've just been doing enough. So I think it's important for students to have a look at what they're passionate about. Note that there's only a limited amount of work life as well. And where you can make the biggest difference has been important to me. So that may not be a big factor for other people. We all have different priorities. So it's very different to going into a large law firm. It's very much a place of attrition. It's very attrition driven. You know, there's certain marks that you have to hit. If you don't, you're gone.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they're financial ones. It's pretty hard to get, I don't know, it's pretty hard for me to get motivated about hitting my numbers every week.
No, you're right. And sometimes law graduates that make that particular career choice are driven out because it's not a good fit for them. But even more frequently, they choose to leave because they realize it's not a good fit. And so there are a lot of law graduates out there that give, you know, working for large law firms a good go, but then after 2 or 3 years, they realize there is more to life than earning big bucks.
Yeah.
Which is hard to tell a young person. I mean, we can say it to you blue in the face that money doesn't buy you happiness, but sometimes they have to discover it for themselves that there's more to life than working hard and playing hard, that there's actually more fulfilling and rewarding ways to work. And then they go on that journey, and then they hopefully find their particular area of passion.
Nick, I think that's a good spot to stop on. I think it's a very positive message, and I'm glad that I could share that one with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you very much for being a guest with us today. Thank you very much for listening to another episode of Crime Scene Gold Coast with Guardian Criminal Law. We're enjoying bringing you these podcasts on a weekly basis, and we look forward to bringing you many more. We've got a Patreon page where you can subscribe. That'll assist us in bringing you future episodes, and also any money raised through that goes towards a youth help program that we're running. We look forward to your company for many months to come. Thank you.